Hello, everybody. It's a nice and a small course. Actually, I think you could sit in maybe a little bit more better way so I can see really everybody. Because Dindin, you're a bit. If you move a little bit, then I can see you and you can see me. Or you could move maybe there next to Maki also. You know that you have free view, not on me.
She wants a wall.
Oh, you want to have the wall. You can stay there, that's fine. I'm just talking about people who can't see me and I can't see. That's fine. Wherever you feel comfortable. I mean, you can move around now, but then as you found your spot, I would like you to really stay there. Yeah? So you want the wall. Don't you want to, if you need to rest, maybe a chair would be better, you know?
Once in a while, I will need the
warmth. Okay. So, when you will need the... Yeah, exactly. So, maybe Ayele changes a little bit, and then... Great. And then you can move one forward, and you can sit in the middle of the mattress, and then you have the... Yeah. Because, you know, I mean, we're so... The group is so small, so it would be a bit silly if we have to lean in order to see something, isn't it? So I think the group is quite small because, the rules are quite strict to be able to participate on this course. I hope you do understand the rules are actually for your own benefit and not for the benefit of anybody else, although it might seem quite sometimes even impossible or difficult to abide by them. But they're good. These rules. That's the thing, because, you know, we're talking about the big thing, taking refuge, attaining full enlightenment. So there's definitely moments when we have to make decisions and we have to, you know, take priorities. And so if we are, you know, if it would be for me, then nobody would attain enlightenment because I'm not strict enough with the people. So I'm quite happy that sometimes there is just, you know, programs where they say, either you do this or you don't come. And I think it's really good. Even though it means that sometimes people can't come. So, but we're not doing just this one, so there's also other things you can come. And especially I think that rule for sitting down every day and meditating 20 minutes or how long?
At least
20 minutes. I mean, that will really help your practice and you will then really feel some result, because otherwise for years and years and years and years you run from one course to the other and there's not much change in your mind. Maybe there's a little bit change in attitude in daily life, but really a change of mind where you feel, where you have these moments of deep relaxation and openness and spaciousness and you feel totally well, you will be lacking them. And if you don't sit down and meditate, if you don't practice, and then, you know, I mean, then who is going to believe in their Buddha nature if you never have some glimpse of it? And the glimpse of it, of course, you can read books about Buddha nature, you can watch videos, the lamas talking about Buddha nature, but then it seems so far away, you know, and it seems so... unattainable for us because we're so confused and we never make any progress. So the sitting practice is very much part of this whole thing. Yeah. And you will have to, the more you're forced to do it, the more you will come to the point where nobody will have to force you anymore and you just do it normally and naturally, right?
For 20 minutes minimum,
beginners
start for as much as they can.
Okay. Thank you. So did you hear? So for the beginners, you start as much as you can, and then you increase. Is that right? Like this, but daily. And this is, you know, this is what is really important. So it's a commitment that you're making or you're taking. It's not a commitment towards the group. It's a commitment towards your own enlightenment, you know, that's it. And without that, when there's, as I'm saying, when there's no, when you don't feel anything, when it's just intellectual knowledge, then the joy in your path is missing. And you can't give it the importance that it needs or that it deserves if you do want to attain that quite high goal of full awakening, right? So the topic of this weekend is like taking refuge. So what we will be looking at is what are these three jewels, you know, that we take refuge in, the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. What do we need? What kind of mind states do we need in order to take refuge? Then we'll have to look at this terrible thing which is called, can anybody guess?
Suffering?
No.
Death?
No. More difficult.
Emptiness.
No. Something smells a little bit burnt. I wonder what it is.
It's out.
Is
the wedding
outside? It's the wedding who smells bad.
Yeah.
Smells like burned rubber. What, they burned rubber at the wedding?
Meat.
Yes. It smells like rubber. Anyway, okay. No, no, not emptiness, not dukkha. Not, we will look at dukkha also. No, not to worry. We'll death maybe also. We'll talk about... Your own mind is a very good answer, because that answer is always right, because this is what it's all about. Oh, it's not about, it's not what I was looking for. It's all about our own mind. It's not about somebody else's mind. It's about our own mind, and it's about to understand these two levels of mind. Yeah, right? The basis, the nature of the mind, which is pure and clear and spacious and everything else we want. And then the conventional mind, or the day-to-day mind that we have, that is covering up, unfortunately, this Buddha nature. So this is these two minds that we need to understand. And I think the first one, the Buddha nature, is like, well, first we have to listen, and then we see, well, does it make sense, you know? I have to meditate on this maybe and reflect very deeply. Do I believe that I have Buddha nature? Because without that, you probably won't get very far. No, I was thinking of something else that goes with refuge. When do you become a Buddhist? When you have generated?
The forces.
Yeah, the forces, when you accept them, let's say, because generated, realized, because one of them is like everything is, you know, there's no self, there's no separate self, because so if you would have to realize that before you become Buddhist, then... Yeah, right. You just to accept them, that's fine. That they are, to see them as true.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So that's also one thing. We'll look at this. What is that? You seem to know everything already, so, but not what I'm looking for. When do you...
I had a glimpse for what you want, what you're searching, but it escaped because we could do this.
Yeah.
Become a Buddhist?
Yeah.
Afraid. Renunciation, no?
Yeah. Renunciation. You really embark on the Buddhist path when you have generated renunciation. That's the Hinayana path, okay? Now, that's a terrible word, isn't it? Renunciation. Oh my gosh, now they're going to take all the pleasures away from me. And it...
Gila translated it very nice. Gila translated it immediate...
Definite emergence.
Definite emergence.
This is nice. Lama Yeshe's word,
it's very nice.
Okay? So that's what we have to look for. So sometimes it's also called the heart of sadness. This is Garrett who translated it like this. Like being fed up. Not being interested in all these wonderful things in you know, in our daily lives anymore. Kind of not putting so much... No, still putting effort into having a good life, because otherwise you can't practice. This is the other thing. But understanding that even though they're so beautiful and even though it's very nice, but they will never give what I really want. So what do we want? It's a question. Anybody can answer as you please.
To be happy.
To be happy.
To be happy is in a deep notion, not in a simple notion.
Meaning? Lasting happiness. You see, we all have glimpses of happiness, But what we really yearn for is lasting happiness. So let's just do a short reflection on that and try to find this mind, because this is the one that then will lead you to really look for it. So also at the beginning of this path, actually, and this is in the Lamrim, you might remember, then also, I also forgot, actually, one generates what is called the six attitudes. Do you remember those? I'm sure you heard them, because I know I talked about them here in Israel. The first one is very important. Seeing ourselves as the patient, as a patient, as a sick person. Because you see, when you really understand that you're sick, it is only then that you're going to try to find a doctor. And when we are sick, we kind of have this yearning that is based not on blind faith, but on some trust that we can get well again, because there was a point where we didn't have this sickness. So this is why then we go through the effort of having an operation, or, you know, or going to the, I don't know, doing some therapy or whatever, doing some cure, taking medicine, which is really bitter and disgusting and all that. So for this to really stick in your in our mind, we have to think about this all the time. You know, we think we're normal and we think we're okay, isn't it? Gut feeling. I mean, of course, in a Buddhist course, intellectually, if I ask you, do you think you're normal, you would all say, no, I'm deluded because I don't understand emptiness, or I don't see it directly, and all these very nice, and because I believe in an inherently, independently, self-existing, what else, substantial, partless I. You know, we would be able to give all these answers. But do we really have the attitude? You know, it's not just an intellectual thing. It's an attitude of being a patient. Because if we would have the attitude of being patient, you see, if you are sick and you make an appointment with the doctor, and then the doctor, you know, you want to go as quickly as possible, I guess, unless you're really afraid, or then you sometimes also one tries to postpone it, but when one feels really uncomfortable by postponing it, don't know if you're one of these people, I tend to be like that, you know, then I need somebody else in me who says, come on, pick up the phone and make an appointment. And the moment I make the appointment, I feel much better, you know, because postponing it, we all know, again, here, that it's not helping, but still, one has a tendency to do it. So it's the same with our spiritual practice, you know. So actually, it's a very good example. But if the doctor then tells you, okay, you can come tomorrow, and then you say, oh, no, tomorrow I can't come. I have other things to do, excuse me, you know. Or, oh, my son is coming. Or, you know, oh, tomorrow I plan to go to the beach because they said the weather is really nice. Can I come today after tomorrow? Would you talk like this to the doctor? But let's say he tells you come today, okay, or he tells you come in 2 months. And then, okay, so he tells you to come in 2 months, the 2 months are finished, and you see that tomorrow is, oh man, I have to go to the doctor, but it's not convenient because I was, my friend from abroad is coming and then they're leaving again, and I won't see them. Would you call up the doctor and ask for a postponement of the appointment? What about, huh? If you really understand that you're sick, if you have the attitude of being a patient, you would rather go to see your friend from abroad who cannot help you than the doctor. Anyway, if you think maybe Ayelet, maybe refuge then is not for you.
She's still young, she doesn't understand.
If you never have to break your leg, you run to the emergency.
Yeah.
Well, that's an example. It's not
just
sick having a headache. It's sick. So you run to the
nurse. Sick, like, sick in the sense of being afraid that if you're not doing anything about this, it's going to get worse. Not panicky fear, but common sense. That kind of patient that knows alone I cannot get out of it. Okay? I need help. So the attitude when we understand this is I want to go and see a doctor as quickly as possible. So that's the first step on the Buddhist path. And if you have that attitude, everything else becomes much easier. It's not this struggle always, now I have to meditate, because everything you do, listening to teachings, reflecting on them, meditating on them, is your cure. So the attitude is, I am the patient. That's the first one. The second one, the Buddha, is the doctor. The third one, the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, is the medicine. The fourth one,
Sangha.
This is a trap. Be careful, it's a trap. It's not the Sangha. This is from the Sangha of the nurses, but this doesn't go into six attitudes. But I knew you would say that. It's a bit cruel, isn't it? But it's okay to make you laugh because otherwise you fall asleep. Your practice is the cure. That one is the fourth attitude. Only your practice will be the cure. Not the doctor, and not even the beautiful Dharma, if you do not put it into practice, if you do not sit down and think about it, reflect on it, meditate on it, nothing will change.
You have to take the pills, not that you are sitting.
Exactly. And also with the pills, again, you know, some practices are really uncomfortable. Some Dharma practices, especially if we have a resistance to it. So we choose, you know, we say, boo, this I don't like, this probably not for me. Maybe these are exactly the practices that you need to do. Again, you know, with the doctor, we're not really like that. We're not saying, oh, no, are there yellow pills? Thank you very much. I don't like yellow. You know, or, oh, well, these are really disgusting. And also, you know, with the pills, even though they're not nice, but we're not making big fuss about them. We just, as quickly as possible, we swallow them, and we're not swallowing too much of them. We swallow them in the right amount, but also not too little, you know. Well, you know, Dharma practice would be as easy as swallowing pills. That would be great. But sometimes cures or therapies are really painful. I don't know if anybody of you has undergone chemotherapy. Maybe, or at least you know people. At the moment, I have a friend in France who has leukemia. Wow, you know, heavy treatment. Really heavy. Like, you know, she's in there because they stopped the whole immune system. So she has to be in a sterile room, Paris, for 1 month. And the chemotherapy, she's 70, but she's very healthy otherwise. And the chemotherapy they gave her, they said, because she's so healthy, it's like usually they give this to a young man of 26 years or something. So she's constantly having diarrhea and she can't move. So she's constantly kind of making caca in her bed, as, you know. Plus the nausea and the whole thing and everything. So it's not pleasant, but why is she having the endurance and the determination and to do it? Because she wants to get well. Although she said, if I die, you know, she's not a Buddhist practitioner, but she is a spiritual person and she thinks in a very good way. She says, okay, I die, that will be good for my daughter because then she finally gets a decent apartment. No, and she really means it. If I don't die, that's fine because then I can continue to help her, like, you know, being there for her and all this because her daughter has a bit of a difficult life. So it's a very good attitude. But this attitude of, you know, dropping everything because the results that she has, it came like this. She went to the doctor for something totally different and then they found out that this is the problem. So she went to hospital, you know, not think, oh, no, let me wait another day, something like that, right? So it's quite funny, you know, we all know that we have to die, isn't it? Or, yeah, Ayelet, we know that we have to die at one point.
But it's unbelievable.
We seem to know that we have to die, yet all the energy, when it comes to the body, like with cancer, and I'm not saying you shouldn't undergo the treatments, okay? But we are able to endure so many hardships. Meditating is much less difficult than chemotherapy. Yet it will lead to something much bigger than having a healthy body, because at one point, you know, she will have to die, I will have to die, cancer or no cancer, at one point we all have to die, right? So this is it. The more we can really generate these attitudes, not just to hear about them, but really have this attitude, you know? Ah, I'm sick, but I have the potential to get well. Because why? Because I have Buddha nature. And to start to justice. We'll talk about maybe tomorrow also about the different kinds of faith. Is not a good word, because nobody wants to have faith these days anymore. It's almost something naive and something that, you know, it's like, oh, this is for stupid people. I am distrusting. This is good and intelligent like this. So we'll talk about the different kinds of faith that one has on this path also. Yeah? So if you have this attitude, I want to get well because I have so much potential. You know, a mind has so much potential of having altruism for all sentient beings. And yet here we are, still locked in me also. This is why I'm saying we. This is why I'm not saying you, okay? Because me, I'm saying. But we're still here, kind of locked in our, you know, little world, self-concerned, and oh, I'm happy and everything is fine and all this, but it's so fragile. You know, if you look what our happiness is based on, it's like it can collapse just like this, you know. Something happens in your family, some big disaster, somebody dies, you know, one of your children, that's it, you know. Things like that, or you getting sick, or no more financial security, all of a sudden the state of Israel is bankrupt, and it says, okay, that's it, we, you know. I don't know what happens when the state goes bankrupt, but some states do go bankrupt, don't know what happens then. No more friends, maybe, you know, people turn away from you. It's if you have a lot of friends, it's almost unimaginable, isn't it, that at one point we could end up without anybody being interested in us. Could you imagine that? Because, well, no, of course not. I'm a lovable person. People like me. So many people like me. Have you ever had friends turn against you? Of course. So, and you didn't do anything. And all of a sudden, they lost interest in you, or they got even quite nasty with you, or had aversion and all this. How pleasant is that? Terrible. But then there's all the other ones, so that's okay. One more, less, doesn't really matter. Yet it still hurts, you know. And one would want to have that one back, but if it doesn't want to come back, you know, then that's it. So the happiness that we have in our lives, and especially as a Dharma practitioner, because, you know, very quickly you are able to transform quite a lot of things in your mind. And you have a happier life. You do become more calm. You do become more open. You do become more compassionate. But still, you know, this is as long as we are well. When we're really not well, this is where you see if your Dharma practice is working or not. You know, like they say in the scriptures, it's very easy to be a good Dharma practitioner when your belly is full and the sun is shining. You know. But if it's raining, like, you know, really bad, and you have to fight for a seat on the bus, or you have to fight to get in the bus, I'm not sure how patient you are and think, oh, let everybody else go first and then I'll go. Isn't it? You know? But we shouldn't be able to judge him. We also need to be able to rejoice about the little things that we're doing, right? So it's like, whatever I'm going to say this weekend, it can sound quite harsh and quite, you know, so you might actually even lose faith in you, or lose confidence that you are able to ever do this or finish the path or something like that. So take all this with a grain of salt, okay? I'm going to talk about refuge, what it means to be a Buddhist, and what one does as a Buddhist. But sometimes it frightens people away, because the do's and don'ts that we will do on Saturday, and people say, oh, this is too complicated, I better not become a Buddhist. But all these do's and don'ts, they are, you know, there's to support your practice. Because if we're too loose and too bit ladi-fadi, then we'll have a little bit an easier life, that is true, but we still cannot lift the potential, and we will not make that much progress on the path. And especially, and this is where refuge is very important also, when you are very familiar with the mind of taking refuge, and refuge in a sense of protection, and you feel being protected by your practice, not by the Buddha, okay? Sometimes you hear statements like, if you take refuge, kind of you're protected from going to the lower states or something like that. Well, yes, if you do these do's and don'ts, but if you don't, then the Buddha cannot protect you. And the Buddha is not your ultimate protection. Because if the Buddha would be our Buddha, Dharma, Sangha would be our ultimate protection, we would be out of samsara long ago. But the Buddha lived 2,600 years ago, we're still here. Is there an ultimate protection? Or a real protection? Real in the sense of not existing inherently, but a working protection. Mm-hmm.
At least what you say in the scriptures.
But what about us then? What about our Buddha nature? If we have contact to that one, and this is then, we will also talk about this, you know, the causal refuge, which is the outer Buddha, but that outer Buddha cannot really protect us. But the resultant refuge, which is our own Buddha nature. And it's very important. This is more important. That one is the better refuge than actually the outer Buddha. Okay? And this, I think, in the West is very much lacking. This confidence that we have this Buddha nature. Because otherwise we would look much more seriously for it. You know, we wouldn't be distracted by all these other things. Okay? But don't worry, I really think it's great that you're here. I think it's great what you're doing on the path. You know, don't go into, oh, you know, I'll never make it and I'm not good enough and all this. There's no point. Okay? There's really no point. So we got four attitudes, and the other two are a bit, not really strange, but one is, to be honest, I also don't understand it quite properly, but maybe we can try to figure it out together, because you all had a lot of Dharma teaching, so most of you. Fifth one is that one sees all the Tathagatas as the Buddha. Okay, so all the Tathagatas are all the ones that the one does gone. So I think it's in the Mahayana tradition where one sees, like, you know, all the... Now here we only have Shakyamuni, we don't have. We have Padmasambhava and Tsongkhapa. On purpose I only took out these two, yeah, because those are the different lineages, the Gelugs and the Nyingmas. And I didn't put out any other deities. Yeah. But the fifth attitude is that to see all the Tathagatas as actually Shakyamuni Buddha. Because without Shakyamuni Buddha, we wouldn't have any of these other ones. And they all have the same potential, and they all have the same qualities. They've all gone the same way. And, you know, there's this whole thing about, are there really different Buddhas, or is it just one manifesting in different ways, that you hear different answers. What do you think, Leora? You were kind of...
I wonder if that's what they mean when they say to see your own guru as a Buddha.
Oh. They're not talking about the guru. They're talking about the Tathagatas as the Buddha. Tathagatas are all the ones, the dust-gone ones, all the enlightened ones.
To see all them is Shakyamuni
Buddha. Yeah. Because to see your guru as the Buddha, this goes into the guru devotion category. And they say if you see the guru as the Buddha, then you get the blessings of a Buddha, because it doesn't come from the guru. That's the thing. If you see the guru as a bodhisattva, then you get the blessings of a bodhisattva. If you see the guru as an ordinary human being. Yeah, some a little bit like that, but not your guru.
No.
Yes, Ayelet.
When I got a bit confused, when we take refuge in the Buddha,
yeah,
it's not in the Buddha nature.
Also. So this is why there's two, okay? But you know, having the Buddha here or there, or at least have some image or something, and we have the Buddha's teachings. Right? If we would only, but because Buddha nature, even the little mosquitoes have who fly around, okay? Or the little children or the old people, everybody has Buddha nature. So when you say taking refuge in our own Buddha nature, well, do we have enough trust? Would that work? Would we know what to do if we take refuge in our not developed, or it's not developed, it's not a good word, because we don't need to develop it, we need to discover it, because it's covered, it's hidden, polluted, hidden, covered by our wrong views and negative emotions, right? So I wonder, you know, to have only the resultant refuge, which is our own Buddha nature, I wonder if that would work. Would we have enough confidence? Don't we need the outer Buddha?
At the present, yes.
At the present,
it's
yes.
The only,
okay.
It's the only refuge I can take right now.
Yeah.
The purpose would be to take in my own Buddha nature when I can.
We need to have this present that we have Buddha nature. Otherwise, it becomes very theistic.
Theistic,
like a god. You know, Buddha there, yes. Please protect me. Okay? And you know, in Asia, where it's actually only the monks and nuns who study, and people have a lot of devotion for the Buddha, like in Thailand, they come to the temple, they make a lot of offerings, and they're asking the Buddha to protect them, to have a good crop. And it's not that the Buddha can't help, I don't know how the Buddha can help with this, but anyway, I think when you have a lot of devotion, because ultimately the Buddha does not exist also, okay? It is also empty of any inherent existence. It's a dependent arising. And this is the whole thing about Buddha nature. It's this, the Buddha nature is because the mind is empty of inherent existence. This is why everybody has Buddha nature. And we need to know, we need to understand what is dependent arising. You know, and by understanding dependent arising, then maybe we can understand emptiness. That if things would exist already from their own side without any causes and conditions, without any mind that is labeling them, then we couldn't become enlightened. Then it would be impossible, because then we would be the way we are. Okay. So, but I think if you have a lot of devotion and you trust fully, of course that doesn't help the storms and all this, but at least the work you do, you do it in a different way than when you're full of doubt. Yeah? Or like a child, you know, a child who is afraid and hears some noise in the other room and thinks, oh, mommy is here, and then totally, you know, loses the fear, although it's not mommy, it's something else, maybe the cat or I don't know what, you know. But the mind state, the trusting mind state is a very good mind state. But this in general, this is the lowest way or form of taking refuge like this, you know. But it works. It really works. When you are full of delusions and your Buddha nature is like nowhere to be seen, and you can open up and just ask the Buddha for help, it can work. And sometimes even in very miraculous ways. Happened to me. Don't know if I already told you the story. We were doing Nunes in Dharamsala and met many people, like 30, 40 people. And it's quite a lot of work also. So I had somebody next to me who would sing very loud but totally off tune. So I knew I couldn't tell him to stop singing because he was so enthusiastic and he was so happy. But I got loom from this, you know. And I had already visions, because, you know, in the Nunes you use a vase, So I had already visions of kind of banging the vase on his head and things like that. And I was quite desperate. And I went to my room in the break and I really prayed to the Buddha and said, look, you need to help me. I don't know what to do because I cannot continue like this, because also I was very tired. I cannot continue like this if he, you know. So then the next session, another woman who was sitting at the back of the room comes, and that time there was still like, you know, tape recorders. So she said, can I record the tunes? And I said, and I wasn't even conscious of what I was doing. I said, yes, you can, but then you need to sit next to me because I cannot, you know, I cannot operate the thing. That means that he has to go all the way back there. And he said, yeah, no problem. Now you can. Huh?
He said, "You're lost." He said, "I'll go there. It's your loss."
It's my loss. No. I think he even knew he was singing off tune, but he did it anyway. And you know. And if you have to lead, and if you're not trained to lead when somebody is off tune, that upsets you, and it makes something in your inner with the voice also, with the vibration. It really conflicts. Now I'm used to it. I trained myself to tell these people to sing as loud as they can, so I can, you know, I can really learn to lead without being disturbed. It's great. But then I wasn't able to, yeah. So then I thought, wow, this really works. So I was very happy. I didn't have to hurt his feelings. And so you can say this is coincidence, of course. But I was also open to receive help, kind of, you know, this whole thing we open up and say, look, I don't know what I should do. Maybe it was my Buddha nature who did something. I don't know. But anyway, it worked. And it's not the only occasion, by the way. So, you know, when they, for example, also we had somebody taking refuge in a very simple way in Sanskrit. Namo Guru Bhya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya. If you're very afraid, or if you're, you know, totally confused, or if you're full of negative emotions, I heard people say it really helps to calm you down. Or some other mantra or whatever. Huh? Or, yeah, Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha. You know. Also, when I broke my wrist, that was Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha. Sorry. I went to this small hospital in Spain. And I got an enormous cast. And, you know, the traumatologist who made it, he was like a very grumpy general, and he screamed at everybody in the place, and he was going on about Spain is bad, and anyway, this should be operated, but I can't operate it, so now I put a cast, you know. And then, then we went back home, and he said, by the way, if it swells, it's going to be really terrible, you'll have excruciating pain, so make sure it doesn't swell up. So I thought, like, well, thank you very much. What do I do so that it doesn't swell? You know, so the whole night I was really afraid because the hospital is quite far away. It's a very bumpy road. It was night because we came back like 11 o'clock at night. And I don't like to wake people up to come again. And then it was really painful when they put it back, you know, because they pulled and some other people went there and tried to put the bones back where they belong. So So, it was quite torturous. So I thought, wow. And then he has to take off the cast and then the whole thing again. And so, wow, I was really afraid. And then Tara Mantra, and slowly I started to calm down. I think 4 o'clock in the morning I fell asleep.
Even always when she was taking blood from the column of the wall.
From the spine. Even Nurit. And maybe if you don't know Nurit usually doesn't do these things. So you see, when we're desperate enough, then we.
You are afraid. You need it for you.
So then we do. But so it can also help in that way. But that is the lowest way of taking refuge. You're not going to stop there, but you can use it like that. You know. Then if you don't want to use it like that, maybe then it's also good, why not? You know, why do I have to be desperate to take refuge like that? Or if there's resistance, like, you know, towards these practices, maybe also to visualize and purify and all these kind of things, if there is resistance, it's really good to check, you know, what is resisting? What can happen? You know, the thing that can happen is that nothing happens. What am I afraid of? Or what am I resisting? But I don't want to talk you into anything. I think you all know that at the beginning of my practice, I became a nun very quickly. And I was living in Dharamsala, and I hated the pujas. I really did. But I had to go because I was a nun. I had no choice saying, I don't like it, I'm not coming. I like the philosophy and I like the meditation, but pujas, no, thank you very much. So I had to go. And I resisted it for, I don't know how long, a few years maybe. And I really suffered in every puja. And then all of a sudden I thought, there's a thought came from somewhere which said, just do it. And that was it. No more resistance. And since then I've discovered that pujas actually can also work when there's a problem or something big going on. Yeah. And especially I like to do pujas when somebody else is not well, and then I sit down and do the puja for them. Because, or when somebody has died. Because what else can I do? Yeah. So like this. But again, that's the lowest form of refuge. But it's okay to do it from time to time. A little bit higher form of refuge is when you...
You still didn't say the six.
Yeah, I know. It will come. When you see the Buddha as a teacher. But a teacher that you will never get there. But still, as much as you can, you want to go that way. But the teacher will always be the teacher and you will always be the student. So that's already kind of going on the path or going on the way, trying to imitate the Buddha, but still not going all the way. And then, as Ayelet said, the best way of taking refuge is when you are able to, you know that this is just the outer Buddha, but I have Buddha potential, so therefore I'm taking refuge especially in my own Buddha potential, you know. Like, how many of us have, I don't know, how many of you do purification practices with a specific deity, like Vajrasattva or Tara or Chenrezig or whatever? Yeah, no, have you done it? Okay. So what relationship do we have with that imagination here on the head? With what we visualize? Yeah, but what? How do we view this? Well, who is that? What is that sitting on our crown?
Is it the Buddha from inside or from the outside?
Yeah, what is it? Is it, what is it? Where does it come from? What is it? You know, do we ever think of this? Now I visualize the Vajrasattva. What? Where the heck does it come from? Do we ever think like this? Or yeah. Mm-hmm. But where does it come from? From emptiness. Yeah, it comes out of emptiness.
From our mind.
Have you ever thought, like doing purification practices, thinking, hey, this is me in the future, that now I'm going to purify me now in the present? Ah. Because then we're going in that direction to become that Vajrasattva or Tara or whatever. Have you ever thought like this? No. It's something separate from our mind. The Buddha that came from the Pure Land, and the Pure Land is where the Buddha lives, but then, you know, I dissolve everything into emptiness, and out of emptiness arises the Buddha. By the way, this in these practices to dissolve everything into emptiness always is really helpful for the mind to lose the solidity that whatever I see is true and real and all this. And then what arises out of emptiness is something pure, something that we want, right? We paint a different reality, because the reality that we think is real and the reality that we think is imagined when it's Vajrasattva sitting on our head, both of them are imagined. It's just that one mind is really gross and feels and, you know, and thinks that there's matter and all this, and totally forgets about quantum physics. And the other mind, who thinks about emptiness and all this, is a little bit more pure, and then can paint a purer picture, that's all. But both of it is imagination. It's only that one looks real, and the other one we know it's imagination. This is why these practices of visualizing the Buddha in a form of light really help the mind to understand its own nature. Okay, this is why we do that. What we'll have to find, do you remember that John gave you this Shakyamuni Buddha meditation? These booklet, these little booklets that you used for shamatha also? Sean, Venerable Sean.
I heard John.
Not John, Sean. Because this is what we're, this is what I'll, this is what I would like to do with you, but we'll have to see if we find them in the... Yeah, probably. Yeah. 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 So maybe we have some more in the with the text. I'll go through them while you have this. With the yeah, then yeah. So because we'll do that because this the visualization of the Buddha is very very powerful for our subtle mind. So don't try to take the Buddha too much into the gross mind. Just allow the mind to become more subtle, and then it will start to see more its nature and its potential. So the sixth is the sixth attitude. Sorry to make you wait so long, Tippi, but it's good to remind me because sometimes it's true. I don't finish. I still have this very bad habit, not working with notes, and then. Or if I have notes, then I don't look at them. It's terrible. It's not funny because I'm losing my memory more and more. So the sixth one is you have an attitude or a wish because you feel that is really helping you for these teachings to prevail as long as possible. Because also prevail to stay, to not to... You know, to disappear. Because also the Buddha's teachings at one point will disappear, like everything disappears. You know, Switzerland will disappear, Israel will disappear, the Gaza Strip will not be the Gaza Strip anymore, Europe will not be the Europe Union anymore, it will be something totally different. As it, you know, if we look at history, these things, these borders change all the time. It's only when we're there that we think it will be like this. I tell you, if I tell Swiss people, they're shocked, you know. That Switzerland will, yes, it, you know, we have all these foreigners coming now and all these refugees and they want to protect their Swissness. And I said, just relax, you know. At one point, Switzerland will not be Switzerland anymore. As it was like 700 years ago, it was not Switzerland, it was part of Austria. Only 700 years ago. It's not very long. So like this, so for them to stay alone. And because it said also the Buddha's teachings at one point, nobody will know them, nobody will practice them, you know, like that. Because this Shakyamuni Buddha is already the fourth Buddha. There were like three other Buddhas before him, only in this, era, only in this Zeitalter, only in this time that we have, in this universe. But there's other universes and all this. So it's much bigger than we can ever imagine that it is. So what can we do? You know, so this wish for the teachings to prevail a long time, what this attitude, what will that attitude make us do?
To direct our next lives to those directions.
For example? But what is a good way for the teachings to really be practiced so that we're not the only ones? What would be a very good way? To have Sangha. Yeah, who? The others? Us.
Moi.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the best way. That if you can inspire people by living the Buddhist path. To do these do's and don'ts. You know? Especially the do's and don'ts of the Dharma. We have a responsibility. If we call ourselves Buddhists, we have a responsibility. The Dalai Lama at one point, he told a group of Westerners, I was with them, he said, oh, when you go back to the West, don't tell them that you're Buddhists, because they know how you should behave, and then you don't behave like this, and then, you know, Buddhism gets a bad reputation. Yes, Nisi.
I remember that Gengasula once said, I think he gave a teaching about
Good.
And he, else can I remember? That's what the only thing I remember from them, because I know it was the first thing that he said, and then he continued, I don't remember the rest. But he said that the Buddhas are the persons that stopped all the negative things from the mind. It's completely cut. And I think about the fifth one, I don't know if it clarifies much, but that we can, when we look about all the Dakatas, or the deities that we practice, I don't know what that means, Dakatas, when you practice, and you see them as the Buddha who stopped all the negative things from his mind. Maybe that's the inspiration. That's what he's talking about.
To see all the Tathagatas as Shakyamuni.
Yeah, they stopped all the negative.
Yeah. They have to, but not just that, by the way. The word Sangye, the Buddha in Tibetan, Buddha in Sanskrit, you know what it means, yeah? What does it mean?
The awakened.
Huh?
The awakened.
The awakened one. Sometimes people say enlightenment. It's not, because enlightenment is not such a great word. The awakened one. Right? And we are dreaming. And we don't know we're dreaming. We think what we, you know, that we are awake also. So as opposed to us, we are stuck in the dream of what? What's the dream that we're stuck in? What is it that we very firmly believe in?
Reality.
A real reality, a true reality, a reality, a static reality, that everything is exactly the way I see it. And everybody sees it like that, and like that, inherent existence. Things existing from their own side, you know. Same way, you know, I mean, when we dream, everything looks totally real. You go along with emotions, and the story evolves, and there's nobody there. You're alone, it's your mind. And this is why, you know, this practice of dream yoga, when you can sleep a lot, actually, in the dream yoga. You have to sleep a lot. But you train to recognize the dream as dream. And not to give the dream some special significance or whatever. This is then what people try to do, you know. Most of the time, we try to put some reality in the dream, but in Buddhism, it's the other way around. You try to take the reality away from daily life by seeing in the dream, the mind produces everything. There's nothing there. Or there is something there. And I told some of you already the story of my dream with the Dalai Lama, which wasn't very pleasant because I was behaving in a very bad way. But I started to understand a little bit the dream. That, or you know, when they say in conventional reality there is a basis, but that basis is really, really subtle. You know, when they say, well, there must be something. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche always says, well, there is the basis that the mind then labels whatever. And so people then, of course, they ask, what's that base? And then he says, it's so subtle that we cannot understand it. So what happened to me, for those who haven't heard it yet, but I'm sure most of you have, but it's quite a good example. Tippi and Itzik, you haven't heard it, and also Dindin. So I'll tell you again. The Dalai Lama teaches in India in the winter, right, between Christmas and New Year. There's a time difference, so it's on the webcast. And very often, these teachings are not on the YouTube, unfortunately. You have to watch them then or not. So then it was, I think, 5 o'clock in the morning in Switzerland, so I turned on the computer. But I was in the middle of a Tara retreat also, so, you know, it's quite a long day and a lot to do and da-da-da. So I thought, well, I'm not going to sit up. I'll lie down and I'll listen I can listen lying down. It's okay. So I know the translator really well, since many years, Tenzin Sepak. So I continued to have the voice of Tenzin Sepak in my ear, and my sleeping, confused mind made a whole story out of that voice, kind of. All of a sudden, the Dalai Lama was in the Rosengarten, you know, where Tipi's been to Bern, you know. So the teachings were happening there, you know, with thousands of people. Then Geshe Champa Tekchok, which is also Geshe I know very well, comes and says, when this is finished, I come over to you and I teach. And our center is 5 minutes walk away. We have problems with our neighbor who doesn't want to have a Buddhist center. So we have, like, you know, there's restrictions and only 50 people and blah, 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 and not every evening and like this, yeah? Because we had a court case also. So all this was in my dream, as if it was reality. So I thought, oh no, you know, at least 400 people are going to come. Now I have to ask, I have to tell the other groups, I have to ask for permission. But I don't know, I don't have another hall, and what am I going to do? And so I started running back, you know, and I saw everything so clearly, the road and all this. So I enter our little center to the apartment. No, I went first to the apartment because I thought, I don't have the permission to use the downstairs center, so we have to do it upstairs. I come into the room upstairs, full of Kopan nuns, sleeping there, you know, because the Dalai Lama, as we do sometimes, you know, the Dalai Lama teaches somewhere, we sleep in somebody's apartment on the floor and we fill the whole apartment. So I told them, look, please pack up your things and leave immediately. And they just, you know, no, it's okay. Don't worry, like, they didn't move. They did not pay any attention to me that they have to go. So I got angry, really angry.
But you didn't hit them.
I did not hit them.
Because many years ago...
Yeah, I hit somebody in the face. So I got a bit, already in my dream, I still get angry, but I got better in my dreams, less violent, but I screamed at them and then I woke up. And the funny thing is also, is like, I was dreaming that I was with Tenzin Tsepa in the cafe there, and we were discussing what Geshe Lai is drinking. So he was talking about vegetarian milk. And I thought, wow, vegetarian milk must be soy milk, something like this. And I'm sure that in the teachings, the Dalai Lama talked about vegetarianism. So you see, something was there, the basis, the voice. Some words that then transformed into images in my dream. So this is how, as opposed to a Buddha, he might lift the whole thing also, but he knows it's a dream, you know? If I would have known it's a dream, I would have gone to the big church that we have, and I would have rented the church, and I would have said to everybody, come to that church, and we can put 500 people, 700 people inside, and it's no problem. But because I thought it was reality, this was no possibility to do that. So when we, you see, this is the thing, when people sometimes think, oh, but if I have to realize that all this is just a dream, anyway, we don't realize, so don't worry, we're still sleeping, yeah? But they think they lose interest in life. But I don't think you would. I think you would behave totally different in that dream than when you think the dream is reality. What do you think?
Yeah, it's very interesting to get up in the morning and say, oh, I wonder what I will do today.
Yeah, but we can't say like this because we don't realize it. This is what I mean. For us, it's still not a dream.
When we learned the mind only more profoundly than we do today, it was really because they say that everything is as a dream. And it was very nice to look at the reality when I was during the time, because we have all many things that we can transform in a very subtle way. Just
like this, or just like, you know, not just what I will dream today, but just when there's something that's getting tight or whatever, you can think, oh, this is just my mind experiencing it like this. Because it's true, you know, like the so-called reality exists only for me. Exists only for the mind that is experiencing it. That's quite mind-blowing when we think. And we think the whole world sees the same thing or thinks about the same thing. Of course, we saw the sunset this evening, yeah? But everybody saw something a little bit different. Because things do not exist out there from their own side. So this is what makes it so difficult to wake up. Okay, so the word awake, the Buddha, yeah? Awake, having awakened from the dream of inherent existence. The Tibetan word for Buddha is Sangye. The first syllable meaning having really gotten rid of all negativity, like with the roots, yeah, all confusion, all ignorance, all self-concern, all depression, all things that disturb, like the word delusion or afflictive emotions in Tibetan, Nyamong, that which disturbs this calmness or this clarity of the mind. So for an awakened being, all this has totally disappeared. Do we have enough confidence that it's possible for us to do that? Ines is shaking her head. What about you, other people?
If you look at the teachers, yes. If you look at the teachers, you can bring inspiration. You look at Dalai Lama.
The answer is yes.
The answer is yes. Not if you look at the teacher. Why? This teacher can put on an act.
We see how he guides the Tibetans not to have violence, even though you know, he gets separated up. For me, it's a big inspiration. I don't know.
Yeah, but you need to believe in your own.
Yeah, of course. When I saw him, I said, okay, maybe I could also be,
Like this. Do you see the Dalai Lama as a Buddha? Or just as a good teacher? Leora says absolutely.
If all of us are Buddhas, so I guess the Dalai Lama has some Buddha.
We're not Buddhas. If we would be Buddhas, we would not be here. Yeah, but having Buddha nature, that does not mean that we are Buddhas.
Yeah.
So you have to be a little bit careful, because otherwise, what's the point of practicing? You see, I don't know what example to use now. If somebody gives me a Visa card that I could use, but I don't know how to use it, then the whole Visa card is like, it's no good.
Yeah.
So knowing that we have Buddha nature but not being able to use it at the moment, you know, all we need to do is to go there. All we need to do is practice the path. So we're not Buddhas yet, but we have Buddha potential. We have Buddha nature. So a seed, or maybe seed is a better example, right? A seed for an orange tree is not the orange tree. You can't eat the oranges yet, even if you have the seed. Yeah. So it has to meet the right causes and conditions to grow into an orange tree. Okay. So this is it, you know, like renunciation. We talked about renunciation. What are we renouncing? When we talk about renunciation, what is it that we're renouncing?
Samsara is a source of sustainable happiness. I don't know how to put it.
You're renouncing happiness? Oh.
To see samsara as not trustable.
Source of happiness, yeah, okay. That view, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, but maybe in more simpler terms, what are we renouncing? What comes when we don't see that samsara is not a trustworthy source of happiness? What happens? What happens to us? What comes? What do we experience? What do we experience? Starts with D. First Noble Truth. Dukkha. That's what we're renouncing. Dukkha and... we're renouncing two things.
When we come to realize that we don't want to.
No, what is renunciation? What do we what do we renounce?
My attachment.
What do we give up?
The worldly causes for my seems to be happiness, which causes me suffering.
Just very simple. What do we give up? Suffering and the causes of suffering. This is usually what one says. Okay, this is the official kind of, what do we renounce? Suffering, but also the causes of suffering. And this is what we have to abandon, especially those. So we're quite happy to give up suffering, but attachment and all this, no, because we're used to it. And how can I ever be happy if I don't have desire? Yeah, exactly. So this is it. So, for example, because I have not such a good liver, but I love chips and fried things, you know. Don't know if you know, but I'm somebody who can eat butter without bread. Yeah, I know. When I tell people, they go, ugh. But my liver is not very happy about this. Okay, so I renounce the butter. and have renounced the chips. Most of the time, maybe I have once or twice a year, I have a plate of chips or something. And because otherwise I get a headache and nausea. So I'm not renouncing the chips because I'm a bad person or because I don't deserve them or I shouldn't eat them. I'm renouncing them because I don't want to have the headache and the nausea the next day. Do you see what I mean? Sometimes we think, oh, you know, we have to give up all pleasure because the Buddha says, oh, pleasure leads to suffering. And then, by the way, never please say pleasure is suffering, because pleasure is not suffering. Pleasure is pleasure. Pleasure is pleasant. But it leads to suffering.
It doesn't last.
Or we get fed up with it, or we get sick. You know, that's the thing. The good feeling never lasts. It kind of exhausts itself, fizzles it out. So we get either disappointed, frustrated, or bored. You know. But we're quite quick in just getting the next one and the next one and the next one. And then we just string them together very close and we think we have some kind of lasting happiness. But as we do that, as we do this stringing together, we need more and more things and they need to be more and more loud or quick or fast. Or, you know, they need to be better and better and better. It cannot be the same thing. So I also, when you look at toys, you know, they get more and more colorful and more gary, like this is like it really stimulates the mind, these some of the toys for the kids. Yeah, what we had these wooden blocks and then you would just kind of try to make something out of them. Huh? Whereas now, not like that. Okay.
So renunciation is my wish to get rid of everything which holds me in samsara, in the 12 years. So wouldn't it be right to say, or are you saying that the afflicted emotions are dukkha, and that's why the answer is dukkha? That's what you said, right?
Well, the afflicting emotions are the causes for dukkha. They are dukkha themselves also, but there's also...
That's what I want to
do. Yes, dukkha and the causes for suffering. This is what you want to get rid of. The problem is that when we hear renunciation, that we think we have to give up something that is desirable. That is not desirable. Yeah, exactly.
But it's an illusion.
For our mind, we still think when we hear the word renunciation that we have to give up something that is desirable. This is why the word definite emergence from Lama Yeshe or a heart of sadness, this is already, that's a mind that goes far further. Understand something, what you are going to give up. You're going to give up something, but you're going to get something better. But our mind works like this. So it's like, why are we so stupid that we don't understand it? You know?
If I know that I have something over there, I would have left it a long time ago.
Yeah.
It's like the job that one asks God to help him. He says, I don't want to help you. You don't trust me. You don't trust me. You don't believe in me. I don't want to help you. And he was hanging on a tree. I would ask God to help him. He said, I will not help you because you don't trust me. I will trust you, I promise you. Okay, leave the tree. Are you crazy? That was the answer. You're asking us to leave the tree. We don't believe that there is something that, safe there.
Mm.
So we hang on to the...
to what we know.
Relatives and exactly. The bank account and the house. And, because what do you mean, leave everything?
It's like habits. Also when we have like a habit that we know that it's bad, smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody doesn't know that it's not bad.
Right.
But we don't let go of it because we don't know, like, we don't want to change.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, why do you think one is encouraged to meditate on dukkha again and again and again and again. That would be if you want to give up smoking. Usually what people think, oh no, I don't want to give up because then I will have a lot of craving for sweets and then I'll get fat like other people. And because one thinks about the disadvantages of giving it up. Whereas if you would think constantly about the disadvantages of keeping it, of continuing to smoke, you go to the hospital, you look at all the people who have lung cancer, and you go and look after them until they die, maybe you would give up.
Or if I think of the advantages of giving it up.
I think it's more beneficial if we think of the disadvantages of not giving it up.
Because personally, I smoke.
Okay.
So when I think of the disadvantages of smoking, I get so scared.
Exactly.
I feel already dead. So I say, okay, what the fuck? I'll continue smoking. I don't care.
Yeah,
exactly.
We're frightened.
Yeah.
But you're going to die anyway, isn't it?
Yeah.
At one point. But you see, when we don't want to think about something because it frightens us, the fear is still there. And the fact that this will happen or might happen is also still there. So if you have the courage to keep thinking about this, especially about death also, this is where the death meditation comes in. You think about death again and again and again and again. The mind will get familiar with it. It will...
Not with the suffering. If I think of the suffering that I will receive from smoking, I become with much less intelligence because I become so scared.
Yeah, but that's only at the beginning, Ayelet. This is the thing. You know, this is why one tries to, you have to keep it up. No, really, this is why the first thing, you know, what one always meditates on and what people are so fed up with meditating on is suffering. You know,
it takes a long time, took me a long time to realize that I don't really know suffering.
Exactly. Because we don't even look at the list.
I know that there is suffering. Let's go to the second truth, noble truth. And it takes a long time. The third one, but all three. It takes a long time to realize that I don't know it.
Yeah.
And I don't really understand it. Because had I known it, I wouldn't get away from it. But I don't.
And the good thing is that knowing that we don't know is already some kind of knowing. And it's a good knowing. It's a good knowing that when we know that we don't know. Yeah. And this is why, you know, there is like so many teachings of the Buddha is about the first noble truth. Not so much about the causes. First we have to understand, hey, this is suffering. And he doesn't say, you suffer. He said, when this happens, it's not satisfactory. Like, for example, what? Do you remember any of these points? The first one, the most easy one.
Suffering
of pain. This we have understood. This is why they give us in the six attitudes. This we understand when we have pain that we want to get rid of it. This is why they give us in the six attitude the example of thinking that you're the patient. Or the attitude, I am sick, I am the patient. Because we can relate to that. So then, you know, this we don't have to meditate long because we understand. Okay? Suffering of pain. It's not desirable. The next one, we already lose it. Suffering of
change.
Yeah? That everything that we experience pleasure with or that makes us a little bit happy, we will lose it. At one point, it will turn into frustration and grief and anger or whatever. Boredom. Yeah? Everything changes. But we're constantly on the hunt for pleasant experiences. Now, it could well be that because you have heard it for so many times that you're not doing that anymore. Now, that's great. But I'm just saying it in case you're still doing it, like I do.
I have a question about...
Just in case, you know. It's very different because, you know, every time we see something, we're not going far enough, actually. We can add something, but I also forget all the time. Sometimes I think about this. Like the sunset tonight, okay? It was really beautiful. So we go, oh, wow, so beautiful. Next point, but it's empty of inherent existence. Just my mind experiencing it. Then we're a bit closer to reality. Or, yeah, but it's impermanent. Yeah, but it's not the cause for happiness. You know that, yes, it's beautiful. It appears to be beautiful. Maybe if we start using that word, instead of saying it is beautiful, we say, oh, look, it appears to be so beautiful. Maybe. Then we're a bit closer to reality. Yeah? And to add, or so that it doesn't become a moment of attachment. Right? Attachment that projects happiness or whatever into that sunset. We can make it a compassionate thing, and we can think, may all beings experience such a beautiful sunset, or may all beings may all beings get some happiness out of this sunset, because you can have sunset and somebody can be totally desperate when they're somewhere where it's in the desert and they don't have a lamp and the sun is setting. You know, we think that sunset by itself, because we experience it as good, is a good thing. Maybe not. You know, or when you're in the Ladakh in the winter or in Dharamsala, the sun sets, whoa, then it gets really cold. You don't care about beautiful sunsets in the winter in Dharamsala, because you know now it will get cold, and really cold, freezing cold. So this is why we could start to see it, you know. Like this. But it's a tough thing, you know. And it's only renunciation. When you have faith and trust, and we'll talk about this tomorrow because now we stop. When you have faith and trust that there is something on the other end. But the nice thing in Buddhism, there's nothing on the other end. So it's like, this is from, you know, what's his name? I think it's Trigyan Trungpa, who said, you know, when you really understand what Buddhism is all about, the bad news is, it's like falling from an aeroplane without a parachute. What's the good news?
There's no ground
to crash. So this is it. So we're kind of encouraged just to continue and to continue and continue and to hear these things again and again and again and again and again and again, instead of saying like, oh, I'll never get this. Yeah, this is, we have no other choice. You see, we have no other choice but to work with our mind. If we want to fulfill that deep wish that we all have to be well, to be spacious, to be peaceful, to be good. I don't like the word happy so much, but to be good. I have a deep wish to be good, not to harm anybody, you know. Not because I want to be famous, but because it makes me feel better about myself. Not even because I want to be liked, because I see how difficult it is for me when I harm somebody. Luckily, I haven't done it for a long time. Not only in the dream, I've been screaming at the nuns. That was Christmas, so that's a long time ago. So, if I don't work with my mind, if I don't have some faith and trust in this Buddhist path, I will never get there. I can never fulfill that wish. So we have the choice of just, you know, running around in samsara, sometimes very happy, sometimes very sad, like an untrained puppy, you know, very excited, but then they're also full of fear all the time because they're so totally undisciplined. So it is a path of discipline also, yeah? So they say it's only renunciation when you No is a big word. But when you have... I forgot to put the Dalai Lama on the altar. He's still lying there. When you see, or when you have faith, that there is liberation. And we will end the day like this, and we'll do some more of this. It can be very short moments, and it's so powerful if you just sit down and listen to your mind and feel that strong yearning that we have to be good. Where is this yearning coming from if we can't be good? Because the more you listen to it, the less it seems utopic or crazy or not attainable. You know, Geshe Tashi told us he was in Switzerland last March. Not this one, the year before. I was already kind of a little bit in a bad state because I had burnout and I had this hearing thing and the dizziness. So then he said, okay, so for the rest of the, for the summer, you can meditate with the people on renunciation. And I thought, oh no. You know, the meditation group is very small anyway. They come to teachings, but meditating, they're not so interested. If I thought, if I meditate with them the whole summer on renunciation, nobody will. At the end, I'll be alone in the hall, you know. So anyway, so I talked about renunciation, and when you meditate on renunciation, you have to meditate on the First Noble Truth and on the causes. I tell you, after the meditation, everybody was sitting there like beaten dogs. You know, this is so difficult, and I'll never get out of it, and oh my gosh, and there's no point. And I said, come on, guys, this is to encourage you to practice the path, you know. It's not to make you kind of like this. And then, because I do follow Geshe Thachi's advice, no matter what, I thought, oh, we just continue. But still they came back next time. And they came back next time. And what happened? The power of familiarity. This is why I can tell you this with confidence. We kept at it. And all of a sudden, everybody started to lighten up and to start to believe that it's possible to attain liberation. And then everybody wrote something about this, what they experienced, and everybody led a meditation on it, how it speaks to them, more or less at the end of the summer. You know, we always want to have something different, and then another meditation, another topic, and another meditation. Blah, 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 blah. So we'll never get familiar with the topic, really familiar. It was very powerful. It was a very powerful summer, although I thought, wow. I was frightened of it also.
Every day? Every week?
No, every Tuesday. Every second Tuesday. Not even that much. But, you know, like 5-6 months. Whereas usually we go from one topic to the other. We go through the Lamrim, or we meditate on bodhicitta for a few months or something like that. But still, always a little bit differently. So I did do it a little bit differently, but every time. But the topic was always the same.
But you concentrated on definite emergence or the out of sadness?
On suffering. On dukkha and the causes of suffering.
It's quite repulsive for people.
Yeah.
They don't want to hear about it. That way, in the group that... they don't want... They, some people live because of that.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear about it.
So yeah.
I want to think positive thoughts.
I tell you what, if Geshe Thachi would not have told me to do it the whole summer, I would not have had the courage to pull this through. But because we pulled it through, I saw the... And so this is what I'm telling you now, the advanced people, the serious people who want to practice, you know, and who want to have this definite emergence. Meditate on renunciation and on dukkha. Again and again and again and again and again and again. Until the mind gets familiar with it, and all of a sudden the definite emergence starts to appear at the other end. Because then we're not so attached to these worldly pleasures anymore. You know? At the end of the summer, I tell you, for me, meditating on renunciation, it made me so happy that I'm on this path. That even though it's difficult, so really, thank you very much, Geshe Thachi. He's the Geshe from Jamyang.
Manila, can you finish the third and the fourth of kind of suffering? Just for the record.
Second is the
key. Oh, so there's, you know, there's three sufferings, there's six and there's eight. Maybe we go through them tomorrow. But I can just give you the list.
Okay.
The suffering of pain, in the category of three, right? There's the suffering of pain, the suffering of change, and then the conditioned, all-pervasive suffering. We'll talk about this tomorrow, what it means, because now it's too late and you're tired. The six sufferings, they put them in different categories. Some of them are a bit repetitive. So the six sufferings are uncertainty. There's nothing we can be sure of. You know, sometimes you can't even be sure of your own death. If you want to kill yourself, you don't succeed. You know, we can be sure that we're going to die, that's for sure, but we don't know when. We can look at any, it's more about losing, yeah? At any point we can lose everything that we cherish so much. Your interest in the Dharma, your Sangha, your money, your friends, your happiness, you know, all of a sudden people, they don't even know why sometimes, they get depressed and fall into deep, deep, deep depression. Okay, uncertainty. Unsatisfactoriness, whatever we find that is impermanent because we have a wish to for permanent happiness, is not satisfying. This is why we make so much progress, you know? I mean, if you look at the animal world, I think a cat still eats the mouse the same way it ate it 500 years ago. Do we still eat like people ate 500 years ago? The same things? The same way? Look at how much what we use our intelligence for, because we understand dissatisfaction, and then we create all these things to be more to fulfill that wish of lasting happiness. It will never work. There's no end to progress. There's no end to iPhones. You know, I don't know how they will. I said the other day, I said maybe at one point you'll have a chip in your brain, you know, and you blink with the eye and then it calls the other person and then the left eye blinks and then they get the message. Huh?
Probably, I don't think we're too far from that.
The Google Glass, the Google Glass will do it.
You know, and how they kind of manipulate. I have this smartphone and I deleted a phone number because I had it twice, and now on my computer I don't have the address anymore. The email address. These things are linked with each other and somebody does... Blah. You know, I better don't delete anything anymore because otherwise I'll be left with nothing. Because I don't understand how this works. But it really happened because I had it twice. So I deleted one on the telephone and now the internet, but the email address was missing on the computer. Well, good thing I have nothing to hide. I don't really mind people looking what I'm doing and where I am. It's okay, they can look as much as they want. I have nothing to hide, you know. But anyway, so there's no end to progress. So unsatisfactoriness. Then the third and the fourth, every life we have to die again and again and again and again. For what? To be reborn again and again and again and again and again. Okay? If you are born, you have to die. If you die, then you're going to be reborn. I think here in this group, I don't have to talk much about rebirth. I think you accept it. And because, you know, attaining liberation without believing in rebirth, I think that's also doesn't really fit together. Okay? At least, you know, not saying, I'm convinced that there's no rebirth. If you're open enough to say, yes, maybe there is rebirth, then fine. Okay? So we have four, right? Then that we're quite a... but however high you get, you will fall. Very often, you know, like at time of death, we have to leave everything behind. But very often, actually, before we die. Your intelligence goes, your hearing goes, your body vigor goes, everything goes.
This one I hate.
The body vigor, yeah, this is terrible. You get used to it.
No, there was the fifth one.
Yeah. And the sixth one is that we're actually quite alone in this process that we call living. We're born alone. You know, when you are grieving, somebody told me, a friend of hers, her husband, just died like this, 48, not in his sleep. He woke up, panicked, kind of, you know, big eyes, and died. Don't know. For her, not great. You know, so there was, so kind of, and she says, everybody tries to help. She's deep, she's grief-stricken. Nobody can help me with this. Nobody can experience what I'm experiencing. Nobody can take it away from me. She understands at that moment this aloneness, you know, when things are really difficult. Then there's moments when we understand, I am alone. I have to look after my own mind. Nobody can do it for me. People can make you, you know, distract you, make you a little bit happy and help you and guide you, but you have to do it alone. So these are the six, okay? Then the eight are... having what we don't want, not having what we want.
This is the eighth one.
This
the eighth one
No, no, it's not the eight worldly dharmas, it's the eight sufferings. When you talk about the category of eight. Having what we don't want, not having what we want, losing what we cherish. Birth, sickness, old age and death, each one separate. And then the whole summing up from life after life after life after life, carrying with us these five contaminated aggregates who come from suffering, who are suffering, and who are the basis for future suffering.
And it's like the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. Like having, because of these contaminated five aggregates of body and mind, having with us 24 hours a day, every day of our life, the potential to experience the suffering of pain. The same way as a match, even if it doesn't burn, you strike it, when the conditions come that it will suffer, it will suffer. It's very sensitive. The mind is very sensitive. Somebody looks at you in the wrong way, boo, you know, oh, they don't like me. You know, you trip a mosquito, it's too hot, it's too cold, blah, whatever. Constantly. There is very few moments when we feel really good, when you're drunk probably, or when you're full of dope, or when you're sleeping.
Or when you swim, sometimes.
Yeah, but not too long. You know, this is another thing with the swimming also and the skiing. Skiing is great, but in the afternoon you're tired. You have to stop, isn't it? Then one would slaughter for the next day. If you would have to continue, the thing is one should force us to continue at that moment. So then we see that the biggest pleasure changes into pain if we don't stop it. This is the suffering of change. With the skiing is really, or with the swimming also, you do it too long, wow. You know, becomes real big suffering. Okay, you got these eight? So this is the old pervasive, or having these five contaminated aggregates. So that's what samsara is. You know, samsara is not a place. Samsara is, how do you call this? We take these five contaminated aggregates life after life after life after life. We take them on because of our ignorance. Okay. So it's actually good that the conversation went into that direction, because this is the basis then for taking refuge, is understanding these things. I hadn't planned it to go like this, but it's quite good. So tomorrow we'll talk about other things. Tomorrow we'll talk about refuge. But this is very important to understand, okay? So tomorrow what will happen? Does everybody know how to do the mindfulness? What do you do? Shamatha.
Mindfulness.
So everybody knows how to do that? So you can just come here and somebody rings the gong, or you need guidance? Huh? Yeah, maybe just for the first one, a few words, so that because sometimes it's good to know. And it's better if Leora does it than me, because I don't know exactly what, because there's many different ways of doing these things. And it's good if you want to develop in a certain direction that is always the same thing. Okay? So it's quite good if Leora does it, and then I'll come at 9:00. Okay? So let's finish the evening though with a very short reflection on our yearning for happiness. Because that is good if you've, even in, you know, during the day, from time to time, you connect with that mind. Because that yearning will direct you into the direction of practicing the Buddhist path. Okay. So I'm pretty sure that some of you, at the moment, if there would be a choice between bed and liberation, you would choose the bed. So this is what we do most of the time. And there's a very nice article of a Theravadin monk, can't remember his name, which is called Trading Gold for Candy. It's about renunciation. And it's not how we work, usually. Because usually we always want the best. But somehow with the happiness, with our mind, because we're not familiar enough with the Buddha's teachings, especially the Four Noble Truths. So let's just look for that and try to experience it directly. This pull that we have towards purity, goodness, space, peace, all these words. You can use other words, you can use Hebrew words. Something that speaks to you. And just keep it. Experience that feeling, that yearning. And then we can think, this is the Buddha nature calling me. It's an expression of it who says, hey, all this what we just talked about, the three sufferings, the 68, is not necessary. It's all based on a misunderstanding. So for us to generate the courage, it's a difficult path. Nobody says the path is easy. But the courage to go on it. And to be prepared for difficulties. But to think it will be worthwhile. Because we all have the potential to be good and pure, spacious, peaceful, loving, and wise. So the reflection on that yearning can be just as short as we did it right now, if you do it repeatedly. It really opens the heart also. So the silence will start now, but before we go to bed we can dedicate, and you have the text, so you can dedicate in Hebrew. And then tomorrow, at the beginning of the morning session, then we will do these preparation practices.